Prospects for the Social Order, Three Critiques and Where They Lead Us. Ricky Schwain said that I might as well have called it Mystery Session, number one, and number two. I think she's probably right. there's enough ground that I want to cover today and tomorrow that it was difficult for me to think about anything that was more instructive as a title for our reflections today and tomorrow. My name is Jody Kretzman, and I come from Chicago, where for a little bit more than a decade now, we've been exploring the meaning of the city with groupings of undergraduate students who come to us from colleges across the Middle West, and along with that, trying to look at what cities have to say to us about where we are and where we're going, and also exploring with lots of various and interesting folks in the city, in Chicago and other towns actually, some of the major critical questions that our kind of social order faces these days. I can talk maybe as I go a little bit about some more of what messing around in the city has fed into these reflections. For about 4 years, I and another person from our faculty met with a group of theological faculty people, mostly from the University of Chicago Divinity School. Some of you probably know Al Pitcher, who has been at Holden often. Al was part of that group, and Gibson Winter, whose writings at least some of you may know, was a part of the group, as well as some other people doing social ethics kinds of things around the U of C. We met every Friday afternoon for 3-4 years. And for the last year of our discussion, much of our reflection concerned spin-offs from Robert Heilbronner's 1974 book, Reflections on the Human Prospect. It's a short book, which many of you, I'm sure, are acquainted with, in which Heilbronner, who's basically an economist, takes off on various kinds of trends that he sees globally and begins to spin out mostly dark scenarios for our future. And it's the kind of book that raises questions which, in fact, you should spend a year on, at least. It did that for us. Well, out of that series of discussions, I started to work on trying to categorize and delineate some of the major strands of critical thinking that we encounter in our kind of, I'm really talking macro terms here, and I apologize for it, but not much, that our kind of Western industrial societies are facing. So I want to lay out a project for you this morning in very tentative outline terms, and hope that it will lead us into some discussion, some disagreement, some questioning. The project is based on some assumptions, which I should surface at the beginning. Assumption one is that there is substance to President Carter's speech of a few weeks ago, on the crisis of the American spirit. That is that although he would put it in psychological or theological language, that there is substantive reason for him to talk that way. that it really is not just a matter of our psyches, that we are reacting to some very real kinds of conditions in the way that our systems and institutions are working. There is substance to that crisis of the spirit. Assumption number two is that it may very well be that the substance of the crisis is pervasive. That is, that it is not subject to amelioration by half-steps or by reacting to perceived crises or by positing solutions to particular problems as they arise. That the substance of the crisis is pervasive, that it is concrete, and that it is probably systemic or even cross-systemic, trans-systemic in its nature. Third, that, and this is a little bit arrogant, but I think that we can afford some arrogance in the shadow of the mountains here, that at least the outlines of future historical change are visible to us right now, in the present, if only we attend to the signs that are made visible to us and attend closely enough to them. And finally, and most importantly, I guess the project this morning is based on assumption about what Holden is, more importantly, about what the gospel does for us, which is, in my view, partially anyway, to free us up to question anything and everything. To look for, in Walt Bowman's terms of the other morning, the signs of grace in the secular world, and to some degree anyway, the signs of judgment in the secular world as well. So I am not myself at home in the categories of theology, so this will not be a theological presentation, at least on its surface. I am more at home in the categories of social science and social philosophy, and those are more the kinds of loci of the signs that we'll be looking for this morning. A couple of other preliminary remarks. I am not going to say anything new this morning. I think that you learn a lot from lots of different cultures. One of the things that the Plains Indians talk about in describing the role of their shamans and medicine men and so on in their culture is they use the phrase, you can't be taught anything you don't already know. You can't be taught anything you don't already know. So what we are trying to do is to pick out of our experience of the reality and what is already in the air the substance of some critical thinking that's going on about the social order and try to make a little bit of sense of it. I'm going to outline three somewhat overlapping, but nonetheless I think fairly distinctive, massive critiques of our culture that I think have surfaced significantly over the last number of years, and which, another piece of arrogance, I think might contain most of the questions that our culture will be addressing in the next 50 years. And by playing with these three, and this really is a sort of play session too in some ways, by playing with these three sets of critiques, I want to open up some discussion about our life together in the next 50 years, how it might be changing and where we might be going and what we might do about it. The three critiques that particularly interest me and which I've tried to pick out of the air that are there already, interest me particularly because they are at least potentially totalistic. That is, that each one of them, taken by itself, calls into question the whole culture. All of our ways of organizing our lives, our economy, our political order, our community, our way of being together. Each of them alone does that potentially. What's also interesting, though, about these three critiques, I think, is that they don't have to do that. That is, that people who live in our culture over the next 50 years, I think, can pick and choose from among these critiques, can translate them into language that makes more sense to them, maybe theological language, can play one critique off against another, can use them not for radical, total systemic change, but for reformist kinds of measures, can use them, in other words, as sign pointers. But they are potentially total. personally, I like some of what I'll say this morning, and I don't like other parts of what I'll say this morning. On to the project. Maybe one other preliminary thing, and that has to do with another way of viewing who we are in this room. It may be that that the haves of the first world are the only people who can think about all of the potential critiques of the society that we're in. Sure, we are blinded to some degree by our position as haves, as over against have-nots, and have-nots certainly have a lot to teach us. But there are some things about affluence, for instance, which we'll get into in a little bit, that only we have experienced. You run into, in cities, for instance, continually that kind of conflict between quality and quantity. That is, do you organize people to get things that you yourself are beginning to think might not be necessary? another way of putting it, is it fair to organize, is it fair to ask people to reject stuff that they've never had? So to some degree, having come out the other end of affluence, we may be in a position to ask much more interesting critical questions in some ways than other people on the globe at this moment in time. Okay, I want to argue then that basically Western technologically oriented societies are based on three premises to some degree. And you can all add others, I'm sure, but the three I want to focus on this morning. Western societies believe and operate on the premise that we have an unlimited mandate to accumulate wealth and power. Number one. Number two, that we have unlimited technological and organizational problem-solving ability. And number three, that we have an unlimited mandate to grow, expand, and conquer the natural world. And just run through those three again, because they'll run through our discussion this morning. An unlimited mandate to accumulate wealth and power, that we have unlimited technological and organizational problem-solving abilities, and that we operate on the basis of an unlimited mandate to grow, expand, and conquer the natural world. The three critical perspectives that I want to outline this morning address each of these mandates, which lie at the center of Western society at this point. Let me use the board a little bit to since this really is an outline, I might as well put it in visible form. I want to cover in kind of parallel ways a critique which focuses on the political and economic order that we live in, a critique that basically finds its locus in the social, psychological, cultural way that we live, ways that we live together, and finally, one that emanates from our encounter with the natural world and that deals with the ecological order. And I want to do some parallels and ask some parallel questions about these three critiques. Basically, I want to call this one the power and justice critique. This one, the mass and technological society critique, mass and techno society, I guess for short. And this one, the limits of growth critique. Again, arguing that there are, and pointing out, that there will be overlap, considerable overlap, among these three major critiques, but that spun out in column each of these critiques can give us a total set of categories which stand our kind of culture on its head.
Number two there, you use the word mass.
Mass and techno-society critique. Let me explicate that as we get to it. First, the power and justice critique. Basically, the power and justice critique comes out of a tradition which is the oldest of these three critiques, and which I suppose mainly is located in a version of Marxism. It doesn't have to be, but it mainly historically has appeared to us in that form. The critique focuses on economic class as the locus of power, and on conflict as the means by which justice is worked out. The basic norm for justice here is a quantitative one. That is, equal distribution of wealth is what justice is about. And where this critique comes from, primarily, of course, in our society, at the edges, but it comes from the Second World and the Third World, the Third World particularly, I think, impinging on us in the decades to come. The mass and techno-society critique. I'm going to kind of short shrift this one because we're familiar with it, okay? The mass and techno-society critique, I think, is an interesting one and could have come only out of advanced Western cultures. It's promulgated by people like Jacques Ellul, the French theologian and political thinker, people like Ivan Illich, priest and prophet located mostly in Mexico, people in our own culture like Gibson Winter in his latest kinds of works, and numbers of others. People like Illich and Ellul have shown us the homogenizing effects of a technocratic society. In a technologically oriented society, everyone comes out the same because everyone is dealt with similarly and pressed into a kind of assembly line cookie cutter. According to this critique, our ability to do things technologically leads not only to the dominance of the machine, but to the dominance of a kind of mindset which we might call technical rationalism. According to this kind of mindset, technical questions, social questions, that is, social questions, cultural questions, psychological questions are always dealt with by focusing totally on the means and never on the ends. The only question in a technologically oriented society is, how do we do it? Never, what is it we are doing and why are we doing it? So, in its mass society manifestations, a techno-society kind of critique says we have an end to diversity. Such diversity as there is remaining in our kind of culture is basically rooted in differences in consumption. Illich talks about the educated person as one who is who not by his own industry and reading has learned something, but as one who has sat longer in school and has acquired more degrees than somebody else. We are consumers of everything, including ineffable things, and we are judged by the amount that we consume. Differences in people and their cultures are thus considered differences in what may be a highly demonic term, differences in lifestyles. I know it's popular, but I'm questioning whether it ought to be. assuming really that the root meaning of lifestyle is a commodity meaning, and that one chooses or acquires, buys lifestyles as one would peanuts or tickets to the ballgame. Everyone ends up dancing to the tune of controlled consumption. So we have two aspects, the technological and the mass society kind of aspect. Both are rooted in the uncritical worship of science as the final liberator of the human project. Connected, but I think significantly different, to deserve a column of its own, is the limits of growth critique. This we know about because it's hit even the popular press in the last decade. Consists of an entire series of ecologically based critiques of growth-oriented societies, from Paul Ehrlich to Heilbronner's work to the famous Club of Rome report. What's interesting to some degree about the limits of growth critique is that it is not the property of, and neither, by the way, is this one, not the property of the left. We're talking about here some realignment of critical ownership. That is, we have always thought in traditional political terms in American or at least Western societies about the left somehow being the bearers of change thinking, and they are the ones who think about overthrowing stuff. But I think some of the stuff that has come off in the last decade has begun to indicate that that those kinds of distinctions between left and right no longer make any sense. In fact, the Club of Rome report, The Limits of Growth, which really kicked off a lot of the thinking around the issue of growth, had its roots in primarily European and American corporate leadership. The limits of growth critique obviously locates the basic dilemma of our time in the destruction of the natural order, in our unwillingness to shift from our historically based drive to dominate nature, and from our attachment to long-standing notions of material progress, which can lead us only to the inevitable clash with the limits of the ecosystem. Clearly, we're seeing that unfold more and more rapidly in our day-to-day lives these days. Let's stare at these a little bit more and see what we come up with. This is really an experiment, so bear with me as I am thinking out loud here and losing my papers as I do it. Let's think comparatively about the different sorts of questions that these three things raise for us. Let's ask a question, first of all, about what norm or vision informs each of these critiques. I argued in the brief introduction that the norm and vision, at least, we're not talking about practice here of various versions of Marxism in the second or third world, but we're talking about the norm of vision. That the norm of vision here is clearly a quantitative one based on notions of justice and equity. As we move to the mass and technological society critique, interesting. The norm or vision really is not a social vision, not a justice vision based on quantity, but it's a vision based on the sanctity of the individual.
Can I interrupt? Yes, please. You used the term second world. The third world is a familiar concept to us, and so is the first world. What do you?
I'm sorry. The second word is the world is the established socialist world. That's where the when people started talking in that language, the first world meant essentially the advanced capitalist nations, the second world, the more or less established socialist nations, and the third world, the so-called underdeveloped or developing countries.
Sorry to interrupt. But I
okay,
don't
fine. Count. Sorry. Yeah. If I slip into any jargonistic stuff like that, please do interrupt me. Okay. So that the norm revision we're dealing with here is the norm of the individual and the sanctity of differences. Sanctity of differences. In other words, classic American categories of freedom and liberty. The critique says that attention to science, which in practical life comes out as addiction to technology, has simply eliminated the possibility for individual liberty. So that a critique located in the social and cultural part of our lives comes out in its vision to validate psychological categories, the sanctity of the individual, as the norm to be valued. If you think about the norm and vision in the ecological critique, I think, and this is tough because part of the ecology people sometimes get a little bit primitivistic. There is sometimes as do part of the mass and techno society critics. But we want to, I think, avoid that. We want to say, okay, we are in 1980, and there's no going back. So what do you put as a kind of norm? Let me suggest that the norm of the limits of growth people, for the limits of growth people, might be something like synergism. That what we're looking for in the limits of growth critique is a normative attachment to energy systems, the arrangements of life, which feed off each other and which reinforce each other, rather than depending on the continued exploitation of the natural world for their ongoing life. So that somehow the organization of that vision has to do with the organization of communities to be self-sufficient and to fit into the natural order of which we're a part. Let's ask a different kind of question in parallel ways and play them off against each other. Let's ask a question about what do you reflect upon? What are the central concerns, a little different from the norm or vision? What are the categories for reflection in each of these systems, each of these critiques? Clearly, in the power and justice critique, you focus on the question of power and powerlessness, and ways in which that can be realigned. Power is the operative category in the power and justice critique. So you focus on questions of ownership, of distribution, the ability to affect the quantitative distribution of wealth and power. In the mass and techno society kind of critique, you, I think, focus on questions like bureaucratization, questions like the meaning of technical rationalism, that is, what is the imperative built into technology? Technological imperative is a word that a phrase that's sometimes used by these critics. Technological imperative. They argue, again, that the technological imperative at its most elementary level is simply, if it's possible, do it. You reflect, I think, on questions of unity and diversity. Fish's sermon last night. And what happens to essential human diversity when this kind of flattening and homogenizing process takes place in the society. So you think about what a massified society means. Lots of other issues there that we can get into. Clearly, in the limits of growth perspective and critique, we think about the built-in imperative at this point in both socialism, both first and second world, the built-in imperative to grow and the limited kind of definition of progress that we have inherited from our growth oriented past. Let's ask a different kind of question. This is really outline-y stuff, and I want to basically get into the discussion as quickly as we possibly can about that. Who, we might ask, are the major constituents for change in each of these groupings? That's an interesting question, I think, to ask you about that. Major change agents. I'm taking some categories here to kind of point out some differences. Okay, in the power and justice critique, it is primarily, at this point, the third world, the poor, and some elements of, at least for those more traditional Marxists, some elements of the working class. I'm not sure anymore what that means. I'll put it in parentheses anyway. That's an interesting contrast to the constituents for change that appear in this one, in the mass and techno-society critique. Who opposes, at its root, the technological imperative? All right, let me suggest maybe libertarians on the right and left. Let me suggest crazies, misfits, social misfits, people who, for some reason or other, cannot be absorbed into the mass, who somehow by their nature are not conformist. To some degree, the kinds of primitivists that we find in advanced cultures, that is, the back-to-the-land people, usually highly individualistic, agrarian kind of in nature, simple living kinds of folks. I suppose for me one of the most important categories of potential opposition for the mass and techno-society development are the artists. There are few, if any, other people in advanced mass technological society who rebel more substantively against the homogenizing tendencies of that kind of society than our artists. And we can talk about that. Warren Rubel's been talking about it for the past few days, and that it's worth pursuing. In the limits of growth critique, if you think about who are the possible constituents for change, that's interesting. First of all, you might point to small-scale societies and organizations. That is, the adherence to the sort of small is beautiful stuff. Sometimes they are adherents who have never heard of E.F. Schumacher, but other times they have. Those folks who are trying to substitute other values than growth at the center of their enterprise. this might be my only theological point of the morning. It's possible that that the major constituency for the limits of growth critique is, and it sounds almost hokey, is future generations. That somehow, when we're living in a sort of ahistorical time, the present is all, and we are not necessarily even products of history, that goes even further. We can't project into the future either. And clearly, one of the kinds of mindsets that we need to reimplant if we're to take the limits of growth critique seriously is the mindset which allows us, which forces us, to take responsibility for our children and grandchildren and the kind of world that they're going to inherit. So that, in fact, one of the major constituencies for change, in that category, is the unborn. Tough one to organize. There are, along with the sort of small is beautiful people, lots of cultures which have at their base, primarily out of a primitivist hangover, a kind of close to the land ethos, almost an agrarian-based sense of their place in the natural order. So we would certainly look to those kinds of still agrarian-based cultures, mostly peasant, present primarily probably in the Native American culture in our own setting, which are close to the land as models or constituents for a different way of approaching the limits of growth critique. Okay, one last set of comparisons, and then let's talk and deal for a little bit. What, we might ask, are the tools for change in each of these categories? Again, some interesting contrasts. In the power and justice critique, the major tool for change is organized power, organized force. That is, the way you get power to powerless people is you organize them into a force which is capable of taking on extant powers. Okay? So that's fairly clear. Organized power is the tool for change in that critique. In the mass and technological society kind of critique, interesting again. The basic tool for change that we know about at this point, and there may well be some others, is based in individual initiative and takes some kind of a form like modeling. So that, you know, some of the folks around Holden, for instance, talk a lot about lifestyle modeling, about ways to harness individuals into systems that that are used as signposts for the rest of the society. So there's something about, and I'm going to use my word that I didn't want to before, lifestyle modeling, that is at least part of that set of tools. Again, the doing of art. Art here being understood as something that is totally useless. So I might as well say the doing of anything totally useless is the major tool, a major tool for changing in the mass and techno society kind of critique.
Excuse me, but when you use the term useless there, this is done in an economic or way rather than personal satisfaction.
That's right. That's right.
Utilitarian.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Can you include pure research in that?
Boy, that's an interesting question. Could you hold that for just a second? Can we come right back? Can that be the first question in the discussion?
Yeah, I'll work on that one.
Let me come right back. Let me just finish up our blackboard and come right back to that. So that in the tools for change then under the limits of growth thing might include things like the development of alternative technologies, appropriate technologies in Schumacher's terms. You see a lot of that around Holden and lots of other places. Technologies that are somehow much more in tune with the ecosystem. Along with that, it seems to me that probably the social skills involved have to do with the development of decentralized organizations, so that some skills in decentralizing organization are somehow also a part of the ecological and limits of growth critique, simply because you can't probably develop alternative technology and use it without also developing the social organizational forms to use it in. Okay.
So that then get back into column two, where you've got mass technological.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Lots of feed in, mm-hmm. back and forth between these two. Yeah. Okay, since questions are coming, let's stop there. and deal with some questions. Let me just say before that what I want to do tomorrow morning with this stuff, today let's focus on trying to understand this, at least as far as I do. I'm just sharing some wild stuff here. Tomorrow what I want to do is to take these categories and try to see what they mean for Christian communities interested in seeing the signs and moving with them. Okay, back to the question about pure research. I guess my question under this kind of a setting, but also this kind of a setting, is whether or not there's any such thing as pure research. And I've argued with scientist friends about this. And I recognize that it's an important distinction within the scientific community. But I'm not sure that post-Hiroshima we really in any area can talk meaningfully about a distinction which is absolute between pure research and the application of that research in technology. No scientist simply has control of what it is he or she finds out. So that I would...
You think first control fails the final of that research?
Well, clearly not. No, that's exactly what I'm saying.
But how it's used depends on.
Nope. Yeah. So I would guess. Let me just finish. I think that I would not say that the pure researcher is equivalent to the artist as a subversive in this category. I would say that if research scientists want to join the opposition to the mass and technological society, rather what they ought to do is to pay more and more attention to the uses of their research, rather than living in the illusory world that says what I'm doing is somehow separated from the uses that my research will be put for.
It's a very individualistic thing. Granted, of course, to get the research paid for, mm-hmm. there has to be a practical value. That kills the pure idea.
Sure.
But it still means that the person who is at least attempting pure research, whether it's in the natural sciences or whether it's in the social sciences, is the thinker who is the non-conformist.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I was sort of prompting it in there.
Yeah, yeah. We almost run into the same problem with artists. Yeah, well, you know, how do artists eat?
I thought it was very simple too with art.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we're talking about something being economically useful or not useful, certainly we can't classify pure research as being economically not useful.
That's
we
right.
We just don't know what it's going to be useful for.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly.
By just growing realization that it is useful, period. It's not only useful, it's a necessity.
And if it isn't useful, perhaps Mara will give it an award.
That's right. Yeah. Maybe we ought to put, in the subversives category, the tools for change under the, or the constituents for change under the Mass and Techno Society, all of the recipients of Proxmire's awards.
Well, I think that has come up, that that's part of this whole change thing. There appears to be some change over funding of what versus who. And now there's a starting to be evidence of who is funded rather than what is funded. For some very interesting reasons.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't it make a difference which column we're in as to whether the technological research is absolutely essential or not?
Mm-hmm.
If you're running down the middle, okay. But if you're going to either extreme, I'm not so sure that's necessary at all.
And you see with scientists, some of them, the way these categories and columns begin sort of melting into
yes,
each
indeed.
Other because when I open my mail, as I do frequently, and get a plea to join the society for anti-nuclear from the Union of Concerned Scientists, they are, in a way, trying to organize a power group.
That's right.
And so we sort of move back and forth.
Yes. Yes. And there are many people in the in this category of critics, in the Marxist-oriented category of critics, although not all Marxists, who will say, who will attack the notion of pure research or pure science on the basis that it is always done at the behest of and at the service of the powers in the society. So they won't attack it on the, there is another basis for attacking it, and that is the predominance of practical science over pure research. That is that we are always going to use whatever it is we find out without asking for what or why. It reinforces the sort of technological ethos. Okay. Yeah.
Jody, under the ecology, the limits of growth, it seems to me that one of the major agents of change are the haves, in a sense. There certainly, it seems to me, are a lot of haves, at least, who, for the same reasons maybe that you mentioned earlier, can, in a way, afford to think of the next generation or the generation thereafter in ways that the have-nots cannot or are unwilling to.
Sure.
But I don't know how to break it apart. I mean, it's part of the haves.
Yeah, I mean, it's fairly different. You know, read Schumacher's accounts of trying to talk about appropriate technologies, small technologies in third world countries, and it is that old problem of the growth imperative being to some degree more of a Bible in countries that have not experienced the fruits of it, that have not experienced the growth. So sure, I think that if you look down even just the lists from the visions, the reflections to the tools and the constituents for change, lots of that one is coming out of the first world, out of the haves, and not much is coming from the two-thirds of the world who has not experienced that yet, clearly.
Did I understand you to say that tomorrow you're going to talk about what we might call theological implications? But for example, the latter prophets of the Old Testament might well fit into column one, and that the Pauline vision of freedom might fit into column two, that sort of thing.
I would hope that that many of you will add those dimensions. I'm not. I want to get into some more detail tomorrow about what kinds of things groups of Christians coming out of a kind of perspective that really is not any of these might be doing and thinking about, given these in the air.
And they haven't talked very loudly and made much of an impression. That's part of the problem.
Uh-huh. Right. I think, you know, basically, my basic view is that the church has bought into all of the three major premises that I outlined at the beginning. That there is a clear, you know, that the faith in growth is there. that the faith in the power of science and technology and the sort of urge to make mass Christians is there. And that it's very difficult to get away from White House religion that is cozying up with the powerful. So I'm not very sanguine about what the mainstream churches have done in these three categories, but I do think it's possible to think about ways that the gospel frees us to do some other kinds of things than that. Yes?
In an inquiry like this, perhaps historical reference is a bit of a luxury, but I think it's worth pointing out that this is not the first time in American history when we have been uptight, when we have had a horrible hangover.
That's right. Absolutely.
And I will give you an instance of that from a rather prominent set of circumstances. The post-Civil War, which hit the whole culture very hard, affected particularly the poet Walt Whitman. Whitman wrote and published in 1876 or thereabouts a book called Democratic Vistas, which is very interesting. It came about partly because Thomas Carlyle in England had said in an essay in the late 60s, the 1860s, entitled Shooting Niagara and After, had said essentially this: all right, you Americans have had a civil war. Fine. You have liberated millions of blacks. What's going to happen? Nothing can happen except that you're going down the drain. You cannot absorb all of this ignorant mass that you've turned loose on society. And of course, Carlyle was a bit of an aristocrat and so forth. That hit Whitman very, very hard. Because he had been an admirer of Carlyle, as the Transcendentalists and other people had been in the pre-Civil War period. So, in Democratic Vistas, Whitman looks very, very searchingly into what he sees, and he sees that it is very much in the Carlyle forecast, indeed, that the power structure is in charge, and the railroad barons, and of course later the oil barons, which he did not live to see, but money is in charge.
Mm-hmm.
The ethical aspect of America, says Whitman, is dreadful. Now, for him, that is a brand new thing to say,
mm-hmm.
Because in the early leaves of grass, he was saying, as an apostle of progress, onward and upward, America is the predestined instrument of social change and so forth. It was a 180-degree turn,
mm-hmm.
for him, and it was the what I call the hangover, the American morning after that was creating all this. And we know, if we know anything about American history, that 100 years ago exactly, we were in a mess, and we knew it, and some of us did.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I can do nothing but endorse your
so that this is not something that has already has suddenly descended on us after a long period of climbing towards utopia, and then all of a sudden we find out that everything is not sweet and sound.
Mm-hmm.
We've been there before.
Mm-hmm. The only thing I would argue, the only thing I would add to that is that and as a literary historian, I'm sure you would agree that the substance of the critiques does change as the historical period changes.
It seems much more complicated now than it was.
Yes.
But of course, it seemed complicated to those people, too.
Sure. Marilyn?
It doesn't seem to me that it's happening again. I think it began centuries ago when we began to accept the empirical, scientific way of thought as our cultural way of thinking, when we started to absolutize that and say, yes, reality is what you can prove. And I think now we're approaching some kind of a critical time in the evolution of technology. Thinkers have been very disturbed in flocks of time about this. And I think the Victorian, especially maybe the English Victorian writers, were extremely torn by how they saw religion, technology clashing with each other, and what technology was doing to diversity that you mentioned, individual freedom, justice, how it steps on faith before. But I see it as a continuum. Not that it's happening again, but that we're getting to a point where, especially ecology and ecological analysis, is saying we are reaching the end of the limits of growth. The rope is running out.
There are
a small number of people.
Yes.
The real, I will say, is a subjective opinion. The most knowledgeable of the technocrats or whatever do not agree with that at all. In fact, point out that recycling is one of the best examples of breaking that chain of consumption of natural resources, and, et cetera, et cetera.
I guess I'm net consuming as we are now, without the emphasis on recycling.
Well, I'm questioning a little bit some of the assumption of the whole mass.
The whole second column,
of that leveling out, because as far as I'm concerned, the better thinkers of who have the ability to think of the technology as part of the tool in the situation do not agree with the leveling out, do not agree with the we've got a severe ecological problem that we can't handle.
There's certainly a major, but probably the majority portion of the scientific community at this point still argues that we do have the we will develop the technological skills, the technological apparatus to deal with the problems which our technology has raised for us. Right, that is an argument, and I think it's probably at this point unanswered still. The other strand of that argument, I think we should just be aware historically again, the mass society strand of that argument really dates from World War II. And immediately after, when people were trying to understand what happened in Germany. So that you get the first social political literature about the mass society coming out of that, and strands of that literature saying you can't understand Nazi Germany simply by saying that it was some sort of hypnotic trance implanted on people by a demagogue, that there was something else going on that maybe had to do with the organization of the society, and that maybe is not that exceptional in the way Western technically oriented societies are organized.
That's wild.
Well, lots of people have argued that, and that's one of the sources of this of this kind of a critique.
I think they say that those people who believe that those are forces latent in the organization of Western society would also add that those forces only rear their head, they only become obvious and visible when economic times get tough, when times get tough economically. And they point to the recent rise of interest in fascist organizations in England as proof of this. As times have gotten tough in England recently, you began to see people going to the streets and marching for white rights, as they did in the South last week here.
Well, revolutions are caused by hungry people. Not necessarily in the literal sense of hunger, but people hungering for something. They're not caused by contented people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true of armed revolutions, is true, I think, of revolutionary thought.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, let's mold these. What I really need is your help in thinking these things through. I'm really just surfacing some stuff that
puzzling to me and looking for some signs about what we need to be thinking about for the next little while. I appreciate anything you want to tear apart and talk about in a little while. And those who want to come back tomorrow and work some more from a slightly different perspective on these same kinds of questions, look forward to doing that. Thank you.
Thank you.